personalities.
The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the sixth tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the sixth tradition is Dayton.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dayton. And my sobriety date is April 9th, 1990. That's my first sobriety date. My sponsor's name is Kevin H. I spoke to him this morning. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. I've had a service commitment here since 1994, and I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12, and I'm really grateful that I'm sober. Nye asked me to speak, and I said no. I haven't been behind the podium as like a real speaker since 2010, and I'm rotating off of the steering committee in January, so the second weekend of January I'm speaking, so I'm like, I don't want to be overexposed at the podium, and he's like, you're speaking on the tradition, so I am an alcoholic. I have a body that can't tolerate alcohol and a mind that can't leave it alone, and if you want to hear the whole story, come back second week of January. Tonight I'm here to speak about the traditions. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome. The traditions may not make a lot of sense. They seem a bit obtuse when you look at them. But basically I like to use the analogy of the fishbowl. Picture a fishbowl and you have the water and the fish. We're the fish. The water is the steps in the program. We get That's what sustains us as a water. And the traditions are like the bowl. And if there's a crack in the bowl or the bowl breaks, the water flows out and then the fish are left flapping around. And so the traditions are important to keep the groups together. And the tradition, the short form of the tradition reads, can't find it, so I think it says something to the extent that an AA group ought never endorse, lend, or finance the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. And that's all well and fine. That's just really the name of the tradition. The traditions are actually contained in the long form, and that's why we read them when we do this once a month. And the long form of the tradition, and this is what really matters, is our AA experience has taught us that problems of money, property, and authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. We think, therefore, that any conservable property of genuine use to AA should be separately incorporated and managed, thus dividing the material from the spiritual. An AA group as such should never go into business. Secondary aids to AA, such as clubs or hospitals, which require much property or administration, ought to be incorporated and set so apart that, if necessary, they can be freely discarded by the groups. Hence, such facilities ought not to use the AA name. Their management should be the sole responsibility of those people who financially support them. For clubs, AA managers are usually preferred, but hospitals as well as other places of recuperation ought to be well outside of AA and medically supervised. While an AA group may cooperate with anyone, such cooperation ought never go so far as affiliation or endorsement, actual or implied. An AA group can bind itself to no one. So essentially, if Mel Brooks was writing the short form of the traditions, he'd say, money, we don't need no stinking money. And AA has always been rooted in the concept of corporate poverty, which AA isn't the first organization. It goes way back to BC era that there were certain organizations that didn't acquire property. And for AA, we have this corporate policy of basically it's a poverty corporate policy. And we just want to be able to carry the message. And there are a lot of charitable organizations out there that do a really good job. They solicit donations and do good works. And AA ourselves, we could probably do that. Everybody in this room probably has good ideas of what we could do if we had a lot of money and how we could improve AA and our relationship. And The problem with that is, as Bill points out in the 12 and 12, is that we're bankrupt idealists. And once money gets into the pot, it becomes a problem. That's something that John D. Rockefeller was actually able to teach the people who started AA, primarily Bill. Bill Wilson wanted money. He thought that AA would be better with money. And Rockefeller, he gave AA some money, but basically he and his staff was able to show the early members of AA that big charitable organizations get caught up in money, and they become very centralized. There are people that get paid a lot of money, and they're always in need of money. It's always a hamster wheel, it seems, that the organization needs money. And AA doesn't need that. All we're really doing is we're just passing on the message, one alcoholic relating to another. And, you know, we have this space, this beautiful space that we're in tonight, but we could be in the basement, we could be out in Central Park, we could be any place, so long as we're passing on the message. The interesting thing, and I don't want to get too over into Tradition 7, but AA remains poor, but AA does not want to be broke. And for as recently as 12 years ago, AA had a surplus of money. There was a prudent reserve that if AA went over it, what they would do is they would lower the price of literature, and therefore they would not have as much income coming in. That's no longer the case. GSO right now is financially solvent, but the projections in the future doesn't look good. And as members of AA, we know that we're always going to be provided for, but it's something that we have to keep in the back of our mind, that we're going to be poor. AA doesn't want our money, but AA can't be broke. We've got to meet the bare minimum expenses. When I first got sober, there was a band of Grateful Dead, which I really liked. And being a recovered, sober alcoholic going to the Grateful Dead is kind of like taking a divorced woman to a wedding. It's like, not good things are always going to happen. And so when I first got sober, I said to my sponsor, well, they have AA meetings at the Grateful Dead shows. So with 90 days, I went off to my first Grateful Dead show. And as it turns out, it wasn't affiliated with AA, but I was Googling it last night, and someone actually wrote a scholarly paper on this issue. And it said, a preliminary examination of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Grateful Deadhead phenomena. And that actually appear in the Journal of Deviant Behavior. So, but the reason I mention it is there is a sober group that's affiliated with a lot of these bands, and I go onto their Facebook page, and there are no traditions. It's just absolutely wacky. And I bring it up because if you go to a lot of music festivals, there will be sober tents. And I go to the Governor's Ball, and there's something called the Sober Ball. And that's not, you could go between bands to a meeting, and it might seem like you're at an AA meeting, but it's not AA. It's run by the promoters. I don't want to ascribe any bad motives to the promoters, but they want to have a sober presence. So if a kid at Electronic Daisy Festival has an overdose, they can say, well, we have a sober tent. And I can remember 2 years ago, I was working the tent at Governor's Bomber, like right next to the portable bathrooms, and like we had no say in it. I'm sure that the promoters of Coachella, if they could get $25,000 for the same tent, the sober tent would be gone. So it's important that AA is not affiliated. And a lot of us love the Wilson House up in Vermont, but that's not part of AA either. That's part of AA history. And when the Wilson House was first getting going in the early 90s, the East Dorset Group used to meet there. And the East Dorset Group was separate from the Wilson House. And things got a little wacky at the Wilson House. We love it to death. They take good care of us. But the members of the East Dorset House were finding that they would go to meetings, and a lot of people would come in that were visiting the Wilson House, and are like, we're really grateful that we're in the place where Bill Wilson was born. And it didn't seem like a real meeting to them. And then some people that were affiliated with the house thought that it would be a good idea to have a meeting, the Bible and the Big Book, which is interesting. You could do it, but it's not really, that would be affiliating AA with a biblical text. And so what happened in that case is the East Dorset Group made the decision, we're not going to meet at the Wilson House anymore. And so it was a separate entity. It wasn't attached to the Wilson House, and they found another place in town. And then there are still meetings at the Wilson House. Another meeting came in, but that group needed the autonomy. And I just got the minutes on. I have like 20 more minutes worth of things to say, but It says that this is our primary purpose, and sometimes I've seen people take the word primary purpose and say, well, that means that AA has multiple purposes. And if you take a close look at the fifth tradition, it says that we have a singleness of purpose. And I'll close it out with this. Bill Wilson wrote this in the Grapevine about this tradition, and he was basically addressing people that said, well, how is it that you don't need money? You certainly need money. And Bill essentially said, our expenses are trifling. As good earners, we can easily pay them. As we neither need nor want money, why risk its hazards? We'd rather stay poor. Thanks just the same. And I think in large part because of that attitude, I'm standing here sober today, and we have a room full of sober people. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Vicky.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Vicky, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, you're all so beautiful. So my sobriety date is August 6, 2012. My belly button birthday is August 5th, so you can draw from that whatever conclusion you would like as to how my birthday must have gone down, that my sobriety date is the very next day. That is actually my second sobriety date. I had had another go-round with the fellowship prior to that, and then the weekend of my birthday, 2012, is when I really hit my bottom and came back into the rooms the next day. So I have a sponsor. Her name is Cindy W. She is in Williamsburg, Virginia. That is where I got sober. And Cindy has a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I learned very early on that it's important not only to have a sponsor for yourself who can take you through the 12 steps of AA, but to have a good, strong sponsorship family. And I'm very fortunate that I've had two wonderful sponsors throughout the course of my life, both of whom have that to offer. So what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now. I'm a military brat. My dad was a career Army officer, which, you know, I often get asked the question, you know, what was that like? Well, it was all I knew, so I don't have anything to compare it to. Although looking back on it now in hindsight, it allowed me the opportunity to have geographical cures long before I ever even knew what that was. Because I do believe that I was born an alcoholic. I don't say that as a way of making an excuse. I just do believe, looking back throughout the course of my life, that even before I started drinking alcoholically, I had all of the isms. I was dishonest. I was manipulative. And from really about the age of 12 on, I was just a very angry, angry, hostile little person. I'm still a little person. I'm just not angry anymore. You know, and really my story is not that dissimilar from probably anybody else in this room. Jails, institutions, and death. I never went to jail. I was never arrested for a DUI, although I probably should have been. Not probably, I definitely should have been any number of times, and I came very close on a couple of occasions. Institutions, yes. I did spend 28 days in a psych ward when I was in high school when I tried to take my own life because of how unhappy I was, as all of us alcoholics become at some point. You know, like a lot of us, I've experienced trauma throughout the course of my life, physical trauma, sexual trauma. But really, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what was happening externally. You know, it doesn't matter if you've ever been arrested or not. It doesn't matter if you've ever been institutionalized or not. It doesn't matter if you're the child of divorce or whatever it is. All of us have the same bottom, and it's a spiritual bottom. And that's very important for me to remember, because even today I can still compare out rather than identify in. And I had people in my life who made it very easy to identify out rather than compare in. You know, I had this very specific idea of what an alcoholic must be like. You know, that it was a person sitting at home in their house in the dark drinking by themselves, which I never did. I was a very social, out in public drinker, and that's how I justified my drinking for such a long time. Is, well, I only drink when I go out, so I'm out every night of the week. And I'm picking up bar tabs for people when I don't really have the money to do it because I don't want to go out by myself, you know, so I need to get my friends to come with me. And so I'm spending money that I don't have, which, of course, by the time I got sober, my finances were just in absolute shambles. I started drinking, I guess, well, I had my first drunk when I was 13. And it was from that moment on that I started to drink the way I would always drink. Which is to say that I wasn't always necessarily a daily drinker. That was my story by the end. The last few years, I definitely was a daily drinker. I was a maintenance drinker. But for a long time, from 13 until whenever, I wasn't a daily drinker, but if I had one, I wasn't going to stop. And if I had one, because I wasn't going to stop, I had no control over the outcome of that night. And on the rare occasions that I could have just one or two, I was absolutely miserable for the remainder of the evening, and I would have probably just been better off not drinking at all. Because I hated that feeling of not being able to get out of myself. And I'm a very good alcoholic, thank you, in that I can use anything to get out of myself. So, summer of 2012, like I said, you know, my story really not being that different from anybody else's. Summer of 2012, I was absolutely miserable. But in a strange way, my ego actually saved my life. My ego was so rampant and so run amok that even with as miserable as I was, and even with as much as I just wanted to die, I would wake up in the mornings angry that I was waking up. I didn't try to take my own life because I was so convinced that everybody just thought I was so amazing that if anything happened to me, they would all be devastated. I'm not even kidding. Like, this is the thought in my head. But I was absolutely miserable. My brother was sober by this point. I had other members of my family who were sober at this point. So I was aware of AA, and I had some kind of very loose understanding. And I was pacing around my apartment. And there's a story in the big book that said, and the woman writing it speaks to, she just kind of had this out-of-body experience of like getting up, putting on her shoes, getting her car keys, and going to a meeting. And that is very much what happened to me. The day before, I had opened up my journal, and my last journal entry had been from 2 years before, and it was all about how I knew I was spiraling out of control and I didn't want to live like this anymore. And I saw that journal entry 2 years later, and it sent my head spinning. So the next day, I'm like, you know, losing my mind. And so I went to a meeting, and I didn't want to be there. I hated all of you. But I just didn't know what else to do. And that was truly, looking back on it, the first time that I think I was ever really aware of a higher power working in my life. Because there is absolutely no other explanation or reason as to why I took that action that day. I wasn't ready yet, so I was really just looking for an excuse to go back out. And the weekend of my birthday gave me all the excuse that I needed when I had an argument with my father. And I spent the next 72 hours in a blackout. I remember very little of that weekend at all. I woke up the next morning, sort of came to, like, in the shower at my friend's apartment, crying, I don't know why, crying and throwing up on myself. And then the next morning, sitting there on her back porch, chain-smoking cigarettes and eating greasy food that her husband bought for us for hangover remedy. And I just looked at her and I said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't. And I went back to a meeting and I picked up my second white chip, and that was on August 6, 2012. When I went back, I got a sponsor. I still didn't like any of you. I still didn't want to be at all engaged in the fellowship, but I was desperate enough to do anything that people suggested outside of getting coffee with you. So I started working the steps, was going multiple meetings a day because at this point I was very much unemployable, so I had plenty of time on my hands. Went to multiple meetings a day, worked the steps, and in doing so, that is where I found freedom. That is where I found the freedom, and that is how I became happy, joyous, and free. I was so angry when I first came into these rooms, and I would hear people introduce themselves as a grateful recovering alcoholic, and I would just, oh, you say grateful one more time, and I'm just gonna. But it's true that a grateful alcoholic won't drink. And I have a life today that allows me to be of service to others. I have a life today that allows me not just to apologize, but to actually make amends when I'm in the wrong. I have a life today that affords me the ability to hang out and spend time with all of these beautiful, wonderful people, because the fact is that when we're sober, we alcoholics are pretty awesome people. And all of you are. and I have a life today that allows me to recognize that, and I have people in my life who remind me of that, especially my friends who were there for the decline and have seen the way that my life has just turned to 180, and they remind me of just how hard I've worked. And it is work. I have worked hard to get here, but it is absolutely worth it. And at the risk of sounding like the person who 4 years ago I absolutely hated, I am a very grateful alcoholic today. Thank you, Atlantic Group, and thank you for my life.